Okay, this is our final hour with James Sanders as we talk about his work, the downing of TWA Flight 800, and of course, the interactive portion of the show. We'll take your phone calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your calls this hour. James Sanders with us here as we talk about 800. Jim, what about the judges involved in all these cases? How were they? How'd they handle things?
Okay, well, the first judge at the district court level was Joanna Snyder, or Severs, excuse me, and she treated us initially like we were Bonnie and Clyde, and she was the one that the jury pool, when it first came in, or we're selecting a jury, she personally took it upon herself to remove every juror who would confess to her that they believed that the government could become involved in a cover-up. And that wiped out more than half the jury right there. And that was the way the thing went. It was about midway through the trial, after she'd done as much damage as she possibly could do, she ruled that we could not put on a First Amendment defense. And that was our defense. And the one thing she did do was on December 22nd, 1998, about 6 months before the trial, I decided that, well, if I'm going to get run over, I'm going to get something out of it. And so my attorneys filed a petition with the court to allow me to go into Calverton Hangar and spend 3 hours taking 35-millimeter photographs without being disturbed. And the judge said yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we were stunned. So anyway, I went over, and I had both attorneys with me, and I needed them to keep the cabal off my back. It was a zoo while we were in there with them jumping in front of me, trying to stop photographs and that type of stuff. But the big thing that I came up with, you know, that huge reconstruction, when I walked over, there were a lot of things I wanted to check, but this one thing, I wanted to see the floor of that center fuel tank. And as soon as I looked at it, you see these huge cut lines that some really heavy-duty equipment had cut off the offending upward bending metal, and I knew that that's what it was because I'd seen the FBI photos that showed me what this metal all looked like before it was altered.
Was it emotional to see all that, Jim?
It was overwhelming at first. Really, really, it was kind of like me going to my first major injury with death accident, you know, which happened to be about 12 cars splattered all over the highway, and 6 dead people and everybody else critically injured. And when you look at that, you know, the same feelings kind of rush over you. So, yeah, but, you know, you have to, just like when you're out on the street performing in law enforcement, you have to put all that in the back of your brain and, you know, keep moving on.
Let's take some calls here east of the Rockies, John in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, John, welcome.
Thank you very much, and hello to you, George, and to you, James.
Howdy.
I wanted to make you aware of an article, if you haven't already heard of it, that appeared in Nexus magazine, and I don't remember exactly when, but obviously after the event, a few years after, I think. They said that they had determined that there was a weapons test going on, but run by the Navy, and that it had put in force a flight restriction, which was called Corridor Betty, probably for B. Anyway, commercial air traffic was supposed to not go over the test area, but avoid it, go around it. That was in force until 8 p.m., they said. However, the test was delayed and did not happen before 8 p.m., but since no commercial traffic was scheduled to fly out after 8 p.m., the article says the Navy didn't bother to notify anybody that they were going to continue with their test after the time, you know, the 8 o'clock hour.
What do you think of that, James?
Well, the Dave Hendricks of the Riverside Press Enterprise forced a lot of documents out having to do with that issue, and that was in mid-1997, as I recall, is when he filed it, and I can't remember exactly when he got it. But, yes, there were, over a 2-day period, actually, there were restrictions in the airspace and on the water in the area just south of Flight 800. But in actuality, there were a lot of heavy metal planes, you know, the big ones, the 747s and the DC-10s and the L-1011s, the kind that headed for Europe that were coming out. There was another TWA 747 just a couple, 3 or 4 minutes behind Flight 800, and there was U.S. Air Flight 217, who actually was flying high enough over the exercise area that he was at 21,000 feet, as I recall. And so he was able to fly over the exercise area and was in the area of TWA Flight 800 when it was hit. And there was a lot of other aviation out there at the same time. But they did not stay within those zones.
Did you hear rumors that the Navy ships just hightailed it out of there after the plane went down?
Yes, there was that 30-knot primary that's, you know, not, they don't know what it was, but at 30 knots, you know, it was a ship and it had some pretty good engines behind it. I tracked that. Way back when, on my Windows 98, I had some really sophisticated software that allowed me to use that the radar databases, and I tracked that thing until it merged into the other primary blips that represented the other Navy ships that were out there, and there were quite a number of them. And at the point, it came so close to one small grouping of Navy vessels there that I then no longer could tell, and it slowed down and took their speed. So it went over to where the Navy was and hung out there. It didn't go blowing through them and out the other side. So,
next up, we go to Kimberly in Lodi, Arizona, first-time caller. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Hi, it's Lodi, California.
All right. And we'll make the change.
My question is I haven't read the book, but I was wondering if anything has been looked to on certain passengers that it could have been targeted. One I was looking into was Rodolphe Marier from the BioMarier family. They have a pharmaceutical company out of France.
Okay.
Right. And I believe there was what was allegedly a former Mossad agent on there, and there was somebody from the Middle East. I can't remember his name.
Not unusual for flights like that,
and,
right,
no,
James?
No, and I took it as far as I could and just simply couldn't take it any further. So I'm sure that a very thorough investigation was done on that, and if they found something, we're not going to know about it unless a different type of federal government comes into effect one of these days.
What was the story of the plane being in St. Louis doing some kind of drug test?
Oh, that's quite a story. I'm still, after 7 years, fighting with the NTSB to get, because they did a report on that. They interviewed the dog handler. But my co-author,
it was an officer Burnett, wasn't it?
Jack Cashel, who's been on your program.
Yep.
He did a wonderful job on this. And what has been proved beyond any doubt is that, first of all, there was no spill. At all times when that exercise was going on, what would become the TWA 800 plane had passengers and crew in it at all times. There was a 747 at the next gate over that at all times had no one in it. That was the plane that it was done in. The police officer did not, and Jim Kallstrom gave a factually false statement on this. He said falsely that the officer had put the tail number down in the gate number. Absolutely false. Didn't happen.
That was an Officer Burnett.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I can't remember the name of his dog, but... even that's out there, and the police officer I know he was crushed over this whole thing that so many lies were being told about his abilities as a police officer.
Sad story there, the whole thing. Jim in Glendale, Arizona. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, George. Thank you. My question kind of dovetails into the question just recently proposed, and that was, you know, nothing happens by accident when a military fires a missile. They have to acquire a target. There's orders to run down the chain of command, and the missile gets dispatched. And everybody's suspicious of this government ever since SEAL Team 6 helicopter got hit by an RPG. We lost so many members of that team. So I'm very suspicious also that there was somebody on that flight manifest that the government wanted taken out. So I was curious from the chain of command in terms of who was on the manifest and what officer was and what happened to the officer.
Well, we talked a little bit about that, James. Is it possible somebody wanted to take that plane down?
Well, you know, it's one of three scenarios. I would give that the least percentage chance. But you can't, at this stage of the game, you simply can't dismiss anything. If it just can't be done because virtually everything that can be altered has been altered. Everything that can be covered up has been covered up. So nothing of consequence like this. I mean, what a horrible thing to think that our government would take out one of our own airliners in order to get at one person. That'd have to be a heck of a person. So I would, of the three scenarios, I would put that one at the bottom, but you just can't dismiss it.
No, you can't. And, of course, TWA has been since gobbled up by American Airlines, and it at one point had the hub in St. Louis. Let's go to Ronald in Long Island, New York. We'll get you in here. Ronald, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Good evening. Why don't we have a government that would just admit what happened and say we're terribly sorry, we made a terrible mistake, and this is what happened. And I remember at the time Pierre Salinger said that the plane had been shot down. I don't remember.
He was running around with some radar video, wasn't he, Jim?
Huh?
I think he had some radar video, Jim, didn't he?
Yeah, he had that, and he also had some faxes that went between NASA, NASA, and the FAA. When the press reported this, they just reported it as internet chatter. It wasn't. It was serious chatter between the Federal Aviation Administration and NASA. And I talked to the people that at both of those agencies. I got a hold of their phone numbers and interviewed them. And this wasn't any wild chatter going on. These people had, it was circumstantial because they weren't directly involved in it. But what had been coming through their organizations was that it was taken out by a missile, and they were checking with another agency to see what they had heard.
Why not even at this point? Here we are, 2013, 17 years later. Why can't they come out and say what happened?
Well, actually, they can, except we have moved so far away from the republic of old, and I've done a lot of research on this, but I won't bore anybody with it tonight. We're not a republic anymore, and we have a mere facade of democracy. We have an all-powerful government, and unless the government is forced to start doing things like fessing up sometime after the fact, they will do nothing but become more and more powerful. It is my belief that Flight 800 was the catalyst for everything that they've covered up since then, because that's when they figured, okay, we can get the media, NBC and the New York Times, when they start spouting our line, everybody else falls into line. And when we can tell the public that when witnesses see something going up, they actually are seeing something going down, if we can do something that stupid and get away with it, we can get away with anything.
That's true. Let's go to Anonymous in Wisconsin. You never know what that means. First-time caller. Hi there.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I'm a commercial pilot. At the time of this incident, I was overnighting in Boston, turned on the TV to relax, and of course this came on the news. Shortly after I had started watching this, a United States Coast Guard spokesman came online and was speaking through a phone hookup to the news person. And news person asked the Coast Guard man about the fact that seemed that the Navy had assets on scene rather quickly. The Coast Guard man said, and I heard this distinctly two different times, the spokesman for the Coast Guard said that the United States Navy was engaged in a pyrotechnic exercise over the Long Island Sound. The moment I heard that, I all but gasped. It seemed pretty clear to me that that wasn't what they really wanted to say if they were going to indeed cover this up. As a result of that, sometime later, several weeks later, I was in the pilot lounge at work, and I happened to be speaking to a few other of my coworkers, mm-hmm. and the subject came up, and as it turned up, several of them had actually been overnighting up and down the eastern seaboard before we primarily flew. And they all commented that they had heard the exact same thing, that a Coast Guard spokesman had indeed made that admission. The next morning when I turned on the television, there was no more Coast Guard spokesman. It was the United States Navy spokesman, and the story had changed considerably.
Yeah.
I can add to that story.
Go ahead.
In a fairly recent interview with a Navy person, and that's all I can say about the source, a Navy person who was in a position to know was that my recollection is that he said it was the very next morning that the Coast Guard commander was escorted off the base under guard, armed guard, and this Navy person over the years has tried to track this person. You know, he knew his name, and over the years has tried to track him. The guy disappeared off the face of the earth. So, and it was at that point that the Coast Guard dummied up, and of course the FBI and the Navy took over. And the Navy person that was brought over was a guy who was an expert in the CEC Littoral Warfare Program. That's why he was in the area over at Fort Monmouth.
Skype caller Donald in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. Doing well this evening, I presume?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, my question is, you know, maybe you covered this in the book and I just haven't gotten there yet, but with all the people that say they saw, like, a missile ascending towards the plane, why didn't they come out and say or try to, you know, use the guise of saying it was terrorists? Because, you know, the Atlanta Olympics were coming up, and, you know, why not say it was terrorists under the guise of beefing up security for events like that?
It would have shut down air traffic instantly. It would have been a financial disaster. You agree, Jim?
Oh, I absolutely agree. Now, Jim Kallstrom and the FBI pushed hard to make it a bomb and throw everybody else out. And that, I believe, would have been acceptable. That wasn't what happened, but at least it would have been an act, and the government could have dealt with it. But political powers said no, and about August 23rd, they made a definitive no. They ordered Jim Kallstrom to stop talking about a bomb. We know that because of how he then stopped talking about a bomb after a major meeting with high-powered White House officials.
Jim, the ebook, it's available right now?
It's available on Kindle and iPad, and for some reason Nook is slow to get it online, but we know you can get it at those two places, Kindle and iPad.
All right, stick with us. We're going to come back and take some final phone calls with Jim Sanders as we talk about the downing of TWA Flight 800. Just an unbelievable story, tragic as it is, but it got even worse too. We'll be back. On Beyond Belief this Friday night, Rich Martini on The Afterlife, a great guest. You're going to love the program, and you can look at it for free. Go to our website, click hosts, click the TV button, and fill out the information. 10 days free. Watch all you want. With Jim Sanders. Jim, have you ever had a chance to interview or chat with any of the victims' family members?
Yes, but I had a policy of never approaching them. If they wanted to talk to me, I'd be very happy to talk to them, and I did talk to some of them, although not a tremendous number.
How do they feel about your work? How do they feel about what has been going on?
Well, the ones that wanted to talk to me were all quite supportive. They felt, and I'm drawing a blank on most of their names right now, but one in particular who lost his daughter on that plane, he, because he was the father of one of those lost, he was able to force the NTSB to sit down and talk to Glenn Schultz, the flight data recorder man, and they had a lengthy conversation there. And he tried to force them to give Glenn Schultz what he needed to do an analysis, but they refused to do that. So we had those kinds of things going on. And Marge Gross, whose brother was on that flight, she's a personal friend of Liz now, and mine for that matter. Yeah.
Let's go to Derek in St. Louis to get us going here. Hi, Derek. Go ahead.
George, glad to have you on, bud. And, Jim, I got a question for you. I was home that day, and I remember when the news broke in, I don't remember if it was Coast Guard or Navy, but there was a rescued aircraft that was actually in the air following the path of 800. They interviewed the crew, and they actually saw the plane explode. Do you have any information on that?
Right. There were two National Guard helicopter pilots. There were some in a plane, but the significant crew was the one that was flying a helicopter, and one of them was kind of looking to the left, one was kind of looking to the right, and each of them saw a what they later described as missile fire coming from opposite directions and taking out Flight 800. And they were dismissed because they couldn't get their story straight. But the fact is, and we haven't discussed a second missile because I focused on the right side, there was a second missile. And that's the one that took the plane out 8 seconds after it. It got close enough that when its proximity fuse went off, that it blew the nose off that plane. And you can see it in the debris because it starts to spread. The debris goes 0.6 of a mile to the left and 0.6 of a mile to the right. You know, this huge explosion obviously took place 8 seconds into the downing of the aircraft. But, yeah, it was two pilots. One of them, who I've interviewed several times and kind of hung out with when I was on Long Island, Liz and I did. They're super guys, really nice people.
Were the missiles launched intentionally, not necessarily at the plane, but launched intentionally as opposed to some kind of fluke launch?
No, I don't for an instant believe it was a fluke launch. I believe it was part of what the literature said had to happen. They had to have a launch in that area. Now, I had an intelligence
Here's my point, Jim. What were they shooting at then? What were they launching at?
Well, there were drones in the area. Linda Cabot was over to Republican goings on, and she took a picture. She didn't know until later when she developed the film that there was a drone in the background or a cruise missile. It's hard to tell in the picture, but it was one of the two, something that was steered by the cone at the back, you know, if to left, right, up and down from the, you know, the flames are coming out right from the engine. And so that was there. You can see, and it's been a while since I've looked at the radar, but it's at least two and maybe three what appear to be drones. One was launched from, I mean, it was under the path that would have, in a few minutes, would be Flight 800. And they were all shot out at the Naval Armada. So there was, you know, stuff was going on without any question. But I had an intelligence officer tell me, he said, Sanders, if they're stupid enough to launch an anti-aircraft missile in that area, they'll be smart enough to have a what he called a backstop missile, to an anti-missile missile, to take the thing out if it went wrong. And that, to me, is the number one scenario, although there's an eight-second gap, so it's a little hard to explain how 8 seconds later you're going to get an anti-missile missile there. And so I'm kind of sliding towards the second scenario, but I don't want to debate scenarios. I just want to put out what I know beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's what we've talked about tonight.
Let's go to Frank in Madison, Mississippi. Hey, Frank, thanks for calling the show.
Hey, George and James. You know, I've been waiting 17 years for this. This is amazing. My wife and I were in Naples, Florida on vacation when this occurred, and I went out to the golf course one day to play golf. She stayed at the beach, and I got hooked up with two guys to play golf. So we play golf and have conversation around the golf course. We finish and we go into the 19th hole, had a beer. And of course, you got televisions on, and that's really about TWA 800. And I don't recall if I said, well, what do you do? Or he asked me what I did or what. But what he did tell me, whatever question was asked, he said, I was at the first boat that was at the scene of the crash. And he was in the Coast Guard as an independent contractor in the Coast Guard. I think he told me he'd been doing that for 14 years. And I said, you're kidding. Well, what went on? And he said, well, we were the first ones there. This was actually our waters under jurisdiction for the Coast Guard. The Navy shows up, and it's like the anonymous pilot called in. The Navy shows up, and they had a bunch of Coast Guard guys there, and the Navy then orders the Coast Guard people to leave. And I said, well, why'd they do that? And they said, I don't know. We told them this is not your jurisdiction, and this is Coast Guard jurisdiction. Well, eventually the Coast Guard guys left, were escorted out, had to leave, and he went back to his base, which is in New Jersey. And evidently the following day, he and his wife made it down to Marco Island, where we were. And that following day after they got there, he's playing golf. And I was just amazed at the story and what he told me. And now that all this has passed, and James, you've done such a fabulous work.
Thank you.
There's no question. This thing is totally covered up, and I think you're right, James, that this might have been a point where the government knew they could begin to get away with things. But I've never forgotten that meeting with that man, and how he was just so matter-of-factly and had all the talked about debris in the water and everything. So I wanted to pass that along. And, George, thanks for the show tonight. It's really
sure
good,
thanks.
And it really obviously got my cue up.
I can add to that story slightly. I'll do it quickly here.
Mm-hmm.
In the days just before I was indicted, a member of SEAL Team 6 wanted to have an interview with me, and we were in the process of trying to do it securely so that he wouldn't get burned. We'd get his information without destroying him. And obviously, he was facing Leavenworth if he was found out. But I was indicted before we could have the sit-down. But I did have a Coast Guard source who, on that very night when things went down, he was part of a team that was airlifted into a dock well away from the public, and members of SEAL Team 6 were brought in to clean up the debris field, and this guy says missile parts were coming in, and he says, you know, and this was before the red residue was a big issue way back then, and he says, you know, there was a lot of this reddish color stuff all over these parts that were being brought up, and that is an indicator. You have a reddish orange glow that comes out of the solid fuel. So I think we can safely say that was at least some of that reddish residue.
Jim, where do you take this next? I mean, is a whistleblower going to come forward? What's going to happen?
Well, I wish I could tell you. My hope is that somehow this becomes part of the political process, because I don't see any other way that whistleblowers or anything else of this late date are going to come forward. I hope they do. That could help. But if it doesn't become part of the process of cleaning up that sewer that has become our government, then I don't see that this is going anywhere. But the potential, you know, for people who want to have a limited form of government that fears the people, like Thomas Jefferson said, they're supposed to fear the people, not the people fear the government. If you're going to get there, this is one of those things that you use to take power away from the entrenched elite. If it's not used, then, you know, I've spent 17 years working on something that I had hoped would make a difference, and hopefully it will. Yeah.
All right, let's go next to Colorado. Ron's with us on the wild card line. Ron, go ahead. You're on with Jim Sanders.
Hi. Nice to hear you again tonight.
We're good.
Listen, back when I was living in Houston, I had a good friend that his wife worked for the airline that got hit. And the scuttlebutt that came out down through that network was that in front of this flight was another flight of the same variety aircraft, I think even the same company, that was loaded with high officials from Israel. Israelites, a whole bunch of officials and people like that.
I had heard that. I had heard that too.
Yeah, and that it pulled off of the runway and the other one took off and it got hit. That's just the scuttlebutt I heard, and man, it really shocked me.
Did you hear that too, James?
I investigated that as far as I could take it. There was an LL plane, and TW-800 did get put in front of it, but I'm not sure it was directly in front of it. It's been a long time since I've looked into that. I think it was several planes in front of it, but I'm not positive about that. But yes, there was an LL plane that was back some miles. I think it had already taken off, but I'm not sure.
And, you know, don't you think if some terrorist group had done that, they would have jumped up and down to take responsibility?
Yes, there was some responsibility claimed, but that always happens. It wasn't something that seemed to be, you know, that you could hang your hat on. I didn't have good information on that. It's just that the evidence, as it started coming out, made it virtually impossible for it to be a terrorist act unless they were able to put boats in with something bigger than a man pad, and I don't think anybody believes that could have happened.
Peter's in Orlando, Florida. Hi, Pete. Go ahead.
Hey, what's going on, guys? I love your show. Coast to Coast is the best. Listen, I call this silent deniability. You know, everyone has a profile, even you, Mr. Norrie. Everyone has a certain profile. You can profile anyone. And who's fits this profile? The powers that be. And this is just a normal situation that occurs. I got to say something. You know, when... Who's to know that this guy that got that was targeted on the plane? It could have been a couple of people that decided to whistleblow, and they had something information, whether it was anti-gravity information that the powers that be didn't want them to unleash. It could have been a number of different things. Frankly, I feel that it could have probably been something that had to do with alien technology. These listen, this Boeing situation, I found out that Armstrong made a cell phone call when he said that he's putting his foot on the moon. Armstrong, the astronaut, made a phone call from the Motorola cell phone technology wasn't even invented yet. I don't know, it's some sort of the Motorola and Boeing has a connection together. But what I'm saying is this: who's to say that the person that got shot on the plane was not a person that had set and promised to unleash something on all of us on the planet? So as well as it might be a conspiracy, but this could be something that the powers that be had to do in order to make sure that that person did not unleash whatever. It could have been a virus, airborne, whatever.
Well, that's always possible, but I think the evidence is leading to what Jim Sanders has been talking about, and that's a very tragic mistake that they covered up. Sadly, Jim, that was it.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind. It's and in fact, the evidence says that that's really the only scenario that has compelling evidence behind it. The mechanical is a joke. It's been completely eliminated by the, as you said, you know, by Brookhaven and I can't remember the other one, but anyway, by two national labs. They spent millions of dollars disproving the mechanical.
Lawrence Livermore, maybe?
Yeah, no, Sandia was the other one over in New Mexico. There was a third one as well that did it, but those were the two that I was the one that got the documents out of Sandia in 2002. So there is absolutely no doubt that the mechanical is a joke.
Let's go to Stash in Miami. Welcome to the program, Stash. Good to have you with us.
Bridget Stash, good evening. How are you guys?
Good, Stash.
Excellent. I got to tell you, I'm an airline employee down here in Miami. Back when TWA 800 had happened, I was working at LaGuardia as a ticket agent. A week prior to, I kept having like these premonitions of like an 8x10 black and white glossy of a plane in flight, and I knew it was out of the New York area. It was climbing, and all of a sudden it started to bank down, and then the next picture, it went into the ocean. And this was going on for about a week. Now, it's not so much of it, me seeing it, but the feeling I was getting in my chest and the sorrowfulness and a lot of hurt and pain. And it got so bad that I started to tell a couple of my coworkers who know I'm like a little sensitive, like having premonitions. Are you there?
Yeah, we're listening.
Oh, okay, good. Having premonitions, and I, in confidence of who I could tell. And they said, oh my God, that's really crazy. I said, you know what? I know it's a plane leaving the New York area. And it's going to happen after next Tuesday.
Jeez.
It's going to, and it was horrible, a horrible feeling. Well, it's not the company I worked for. I'm still at this different airline. It turns out that we transported so many of the families of the victims off of that flight. Horrible. Of what, you know, we had to experience and endure. Oh, I told this to also Mr. Francis, I believe, who wasn't he with the FAA at the time or the NTSB?
NTSB.
But he flew out on us as well. And I told him the story. I said, well, for what it's worth, this is what I felt. And my coworker was next to me. She goes, yeah, he told me a week before. And that night when that day when it happened, I was over at Sandy Hook, and the traffic pattern from Kennedy flew right over for JFK flies right over Sandy Hook. I was out with some friends watching the planes land out there, get home that night, and that's when we found out about TWA 800 going down. I was home watching it on CNN. I believe Lou Waters was the anchor and took a call from a very reliable source. They said somebody in the Navy out there in a ship who had seen, as well as so many other witnesses who were out in East Norwich, New York, saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, we're getting all these people who wouldn't normally see a missile go up. They wouldn't know what a missile looks like. But here we have somebody from the military calling in, and all of a sudden that gets, you know, denied the next day.
Yeah, they kind of wash that fast.
It was just meant to be for me to get through tonight. I've been listening to you guys for years, working for the airlines. As of yesterday, I'm back on the night shift. That's why I'm still up. I just got home a little while ago. But as I was driving home, I said, oh, wow, what a phenomenal show. I'm able to listen to it like late at night, and I'm not in that early morning shift anymore. And it was truly meant for, to be, because this is my first time calling into you guys.
There you go, Stosh. And thanks for that call. It was a good one. Jim, we are running out of time. Good luck with what you're doing. It's information. It's vital information that needs to get out.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you having me on, because, you know, if you can't get out to the people, you can't get the story told, and there's no chance for it having an impact.
I talked to you last 16 years ago. It's a long time, huh?
Yeah, very long time. I was young and cute back then, you know.
Well, you just keep doing what you're doing. Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. As you know, it's a split show. We're going to talk about prophetic dreams. Don't go away.